Hello and welcome to Talking Travel, the podcast that talks about travel and news and where they sometimes intersect. I'm Carol Hills of Public Radio International's The World, a one-hour weekday international news program co-produced with the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. I'm joined by David Allen, the editor of BBC's travel website. He's in New York, and Tom Hall is also with us. He's the London editor for Lonely Planet. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Great to be back with you. And today our topic is airports. We're going to talk about good airports, bad airports, fun airports, airports that are distinctly unfun, airports that are remarkably small for the area they serve, and the airport you never, ever want to descend into again, ever. Along with a topic that I didn't know about till I researched this podcast, ghost airports. Those big projects that politicians sometimes push through with promises of jobs, and sometimes those airports just sit there. And there's kind of a remarkable number of these around. Okay, let's get off to the obvious topic, which is favorite airports. David, you first. Your favorite airport and why?
Changi in Singapore. It is the most fantabulous airport ever invented by man. It's the only airport that I can think of where I enjoy going early, way earlier than my flight, just so I can enjoy all the bells and whistles and fun times that they offer.
For example,
they have two movie theaters that are just open, and you can just come in and out. They just show movies one after the other. They have a four-story high slide that you can ride down, including adults. It times your speed as you go down. They have multiple gardens. Each terminal has an outdoor space, so you can have a rooftop cocktail or you can walk around sunflowers. But the highlight, the piece de resistance, is the rooftop pool.
Wow.
It's not the world's greatest pool, but among airport pools, it is
which I didn't know there
great.
Was even an airport pool anywhere. This is incredible.
I think it's pool singular.
Yeah, airport pool. Among the airport pool. Yeah, it's the only airport where you need to, you know, not pack your bathing suit so that you've got it available to take a dip before you get onto your flight. And it's just wonderful. It's relaxing to lie on your back and watch planes fly over you while you float around and chill out before you get on your flight.
Is this a new airport?
No, it's been around for a while, but it has grown over the decades. And so each of the terminals has been added, you know, maybe a dozen years later. But what they do is instead of like letting the old terminal just kind of become sad and decrepit, every time they open a new terminal, they let the other ones catch up. So the pool, for example, is in Terminal 1. It's the oldest of the terminals. But they keep sort of going back and revisiting it. And there's all these just small little details like free massage chairs, and there are places where you're encouraged to sleep. I mean, very few airports have like quiet areas that encourage you to take naps, and they have these.
Wow, I've always wanted that. I've always wanted a little like napping room.
Yeah, it's like most airports, they discourage it. They don't want people like napping around. I don't know if they're afraid like homeless people will start showing up at the airport, but but the reality is most people need to get a little, you know, sleep, especially if they can't sleep well on airplanes. And Changi just delivers all of it.
Do we know what the thinking is behind it? Did they hire some innovative person, or is this kind of Singaporean, this kind of hipster innovative stuff that really caters to people's needs? I mean, do we know what the ethos of this is?
Yeah, you know, they actually – it's very close to the city, and they wanted it to be a destination that locals would go to. And so there's all this great shopping and food there, and they have all these sort of incentives for people to come in from the city, even if you live there. And then the way it's funded is interesting too. All the vendors, all the – you know, from Prada down to, you know, street food, they all pay sort of a tax to be at the airport. And that goes into all these added things that make the airport attractive. So it becomes sort of this circular
genius, guaranteed funding system to keep updating it.
Exactly. And then as the airport has all these fun things to do, people want to hang out there more. And if they're hanging out at the airport, they're buying more food, they're buying more products. And then that adds to the revenue for the stores that then feeds back into the airport. It's just genius. Yeah.
Well, I know. And David, you've written about it, and we will link to your article on our website. Tom, have you ever been to Changi?
I was just reminiscing about my swim in the pool on the way to Melbourne, Australia last year. And I actively choose to fly through Singapore when I can. And I think it's one of the reasons for its success is that it realizes that people pitch up there sometimes in the middle of two incredibly long flights. And it just tries to make it a fun place to spend a little while. So the thing that really struck me was passing through there at the time of the Olympic Games. And they had some entertainers there who were staging their own mock Olympic Games and getting, you know, transit passengers to do high jump and steeplechase and things like that. And I just thought this place is absolutely brilliant. And the other thing about it is it doesn't constantly try to remove money from your wallet in the way that most other airports do. Yes, it does have the shops, which are fabulous and excellent, but there isn't this constant idea that everything's going to cost you.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. That must have to do with that sort of circular funding system, which kind of, you know, allows it to sustain itself.
Well, the thing about it is it works, and everyone you speak to who's been there says it's the best airport they've ever been to, so they must be doing something.
Well,
right.
here's a comment that may betray my ignorance, but I've never been to the Singapore airport or to Singapore, but the stereotypical things you hear about Singapore is that it's kind of unfun or sort of, you know, dreary or
Singaporeing.
Officious. So this kind of challenges my image of Singapore.
Well, I mean, I really enjoyed Singapore when I went there. I still think the airport was my favourite thing about the place. But that's not because I didn't really enjoy going into the city. It's because the airport really, really stood out for me. And
to Singapore, you just hang out at the airport.
You could do. I mean, there's much more to it than that, to be fair. But I have friends in Hong Kong who are constantly sort of saying, Hong Kong's better than Singapore. So I could hear their voices in my head as I was going around. But I don't think Hong Kong Airport can compete with Singapore in terms of facilities offered.
So, Tom, is Changi your favorite, or do you have a different one?
I'm gonna have a favorite and a least favorite,
okay.
And it's the same place. So, it's Heathrow, London's famous Heathrow Airport. This is the airport that was voted 99th best in a recent poll
out of 100
world's best airports. There was slightly more entrants than that, Heathrow was in there at least, and it hadn't finished bottom. It finished bottom of other polls in recent years. It can be a very pleasant place to go through. Terminal 5 at Heathrow, which is the newest terminal, the British Airways terminal, is without a doubt my favourite place to fly from in the world, because you're through so quickly. There's a sense of space and light. You can see Windsor Castle from the air terminal, which presumably means that the Queen and Prince Philip can see Terminal 5 from where they're taking tea.
They shield it from them.
That's right. And that's very nice. Not so nice is some of the other terminals, which are frankly showing their age a little bit, can be very busy and very crowded. And Heathrow, which handles the lion's share of long-haul flights from Europe, does seem to be plagued by this huge amounts of baggage syndrome, whereby people are jetting off all over the world, laden down with 4 or 5 enormous suitcases. And particularly in Terminal 3, there's not really room for everyone at busy times. So it can just be a very, very busy place. So I have the same favourite and least favourite.
Okay, I got to ask you a question about Changi related to baggage. Okay, you mentioned all those fun things, but do they have practical things like where you put your carry-on luggage and all your crap while you go and do these fun things?
Trolleys, don't you?
Yeah, they have... You know, it's interesting because, you know, this is like sort of a post 9/11 thing, but there aren't a lot of places where you can store luggage. But the system, the luggage system is really efficient. It comes down. I've never, you know, I sort of am the first one off the plane. I have my own kind of like little airplane rituals to speed those things along in a up
is
in the air kind of way.
People?
No. I push little kids down. That's the fastest airport in terms of getting my luggage that I've ever found. Like usually 99% of the time I get to the luggage carousel before the luggage gets there. But Changi beat me, but they had this area where you could leave your bag. So I think you'd be fine. You wouldn't have to tote it around everywhere.
And David, your least favorite airport?
Gosh, I think I have two, and they're both been airports that I've been stuck with. One is Newark Airport, where I'm stuck with now, out of New York. It's just far away. You know, it's in New Jersey. No slight on New Jersey, but it's just a pain for, you know, people coming from the city. There's no cheap way to get there. A cab costs you an arm and a leg, or you can take Amtrak or multiple ways to get there. It's just inconvenient. And then when you get there, it's just not nice. It's dumpy. They sort of miss the memo that all
Come
these
on.
Other
airports. Come on, don't hold back. Come on.
All these other airports, I feel like, got wised up to the fact that when people are stuck there, you know, if they're going to be stuck there, and you really are, if you're in Newark, you're really stuck. You're not going to really, you know, although I once wrote a thing about it when I worked at the New York Times about how to enjoy downtown Newark if you're stuck at the airport in a layover. But for most people, they're going to stay in the airport, and there's just not a lot to do there. And all these airports, all these sort of modern airports have really good food options, and they have sort of recreational options, and Newark just doesn't bother with any of that. It also seems to be under constant construction. I've never been there where like some whole part of it wasn't closed off for some, you know, for some reason. They just can't quite get on top of it. So Newark. And then I lived in Bangkok for a year, and the Bangkok airport was infamously bad, and it's, you know, it's improved over time. Still, the one of the worst things about the Bangkok airport is getting there, because if you're on an international flight, and I live there, so I was, you know, constantly flying out of there. But if you take a international flight, it usually leaves at some super early hour, like 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. And so you have to take a taxi there. And you have taxi drivers who drive, you know, already they drive kind of crazy in Bangkok, but they're on like something. They're on some kind of caffeinated beverage or more than caffeinated. Sometimes they're drunk, and it's just, you know, I love Bangkok. This is no slight to that, but it's you feel like you're putting your life in your hands by taking a 3 a.m. cab ride to the airport.
Ooh. So Bangkok airport is no Changi. That's what we're saying.
No.
Okay, let's go to the most bare bones airport you've ever seen or experienced. And I'm thinking it could be any bare bones airport, but if there's one that comes to mind that is actually serving a rather large region, yet its airport is just so bare bones you can't believe it. Okay, Tom.
I think I would have to go for the airport which serves one of the world's great icons and at the same time doesn't like to make a very big fuss about it, shall we say? And that's Kilimanjaro Airport in Tanzania. And I say that because the flight that I was on, and I promise this wasn't because I'd had a lot to drink, but the flight that I was on descended in pitch blackness into Kilimanjaro Airport. I didn't see a light on the runway at all. I barely noticed the doors open apart from this sort of wave of heat that whacked everybody who was sitting there. And then the doors closed and there didn't seem to be any announcements, and off it went again. It was like we'd sort of, you know, landed in John Travolta's backyard or something. It was sort of a complete lack of fuss. So
I guess the key question is, was the pilot aware of where the mountain was?
Apparently so, because they, you know, they managed to do it very, very safely. So I would go for that one. If I'm allowed another, I'd say that Europe is now peppered with airports that are built as sort of secondary airports to serve major cities, and, you know, budget airlines, the likes of Ryanair, would fly to these places. Stockholm Stavska Airport is about 100 miles from Stockholm itself, very remote. And the next plane that came in after ours was a sort of little one-man Cessna plane. It was just like being in the middle of a pine forest. And yet, you know...
And you're on a big jet, sort of regular...
Welcome, yeah. And then it said, welcome to Stockholm, you know, one of Europe's great cities. Well, it didn't look like I was there.
Okay, David.
Well, I'm glad Tom came up with two, because I'm having trouble thinking of one that serves a major area, but I also...
Or just go for bare bones. Forget me.
Well, you know, I have sort of a bias where I like these little tiny in the middle of no place airports. Like, I find them really fun, where you get off and there's no real terminal there, and you have to take the stairs to get off the plane, or you may be getting on a prop plane for some little puddle jumper somewhere. The Caribbean's full of them. They're fantastic. And I just feel like a rock star every time I get on some airport that's barely an airport, and, you know, maybe has like one guy, like the guy who takes the luggage off the plane is the same guy who like gives
is
you your rental
it.
Car. Yeah, is flying it. Yeah. I even love to be on the little planes where, you know, where I'm next in the co-pilot seat and I'm right there next to him. It frightens my wife to no end, but, you know, the smaller and more kind of bare bones, the more I feel like I'm on an adventure.
Oh, that's great. I know one time when I was in college at University of Vermont, and I, for some reason, in Burlington, Vermont, and I flew home, and home is Watertown, New York, in northern New York, a small, you know, 23,000 people or something. And so I got on a plane, and it had two stops. This would have been like a, should have been like an hour flight, but there were two stops in even smaller towns. And it was the kind of thing where I got on and the pilot said, he kind of looks back from the cockpit, it's this tiny plane, okay, you got your seatbelt on? I said, sure. Yes, I do. And then a couple minutes later, we're in the flight. He goes, oh, just come on up here. You can just sit up here. And it's like, you know, and then we had to stop in two tiny towns, you know, that actually had airports like Ogdensburg and Messina or something. It was just weird, but it was
That's
fun.
Awesome.
It was fun.
We also have the shortest scheduled passenger journey by plane in the world in the UK, which is a hop from the island of Westray in the Orkneys to Papa Westray, also in the Orkneys. And it takes off from one, it lands on the beach on the other, and it takes about 2 minutes and 7 seconds to do the journey.
Serves pretty a purpose.
I don't think they serve you a whiskey and Coke in the middle of the flight, you know.
They start to serve it, but then you've landed, so.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, well, now we go to the subject of ghost airports. These are the ones that elicited a sound effect from Tom earlier. And as I mentioned before, these are airports that are built usually with a lot of fanfare, promises of jobs. Politicians sell the communities on them, raise a lot of tax money. They're built, and they end up sitting kind of idle. And before we chat about it, I'm going to play a piece by Jerry Hatton, our correspondent who is based in Spain for The World, for The World's radio show. And he did a piece about just such an airport built near Valencia. Let's listen. Okay, ghost airports. Castellón is clearly a ghost airport. David, what's your favorite ghost airport? Have you heard of any?
Yeah, well, there's one that you can see because, well, it's... There's a ghost terminal, let's put it that way, and it's at JFK Airport, and it's the old TWA terminal. It's architecturally beautiful.
Oh,
it was built in the 60s.
Saarinen designed it. Isn't it that one?
Yeah, exactly. People might be able to make a mental image if they think of the movie Catch Me If You Can, one of the three great airport movies along with Up in the Air and The Terminal. And it's just beautiful. It's very kind of – it's roundish and there's no hard angles in there. And it's just kind of beautiful to look at. And if you're at JFK Airport and you're riding on the monorail, you go right by it and you see inside. And it's had this long history of restoration and trying to get it back. And then it was in that movie and it got more attention. It's still quiet. It's still dead. And they keep promising that they're going to open it and use it. But or turn it into a hotel. There's just been a lot of plans for it. But anyway, it's wonderful to behold, and it's kind of eerie and sort of creepy in its emptiness in the middle of a major airport.
And we have a picture of that on our website. Tom, ghost airports.
I think the most striking one for me is Tempelhof in Berlin, which will be very well known to anybody who's interested in the Berlin airlift or sort of history of early airports. It was actually built by the Nazis in the 1930s, this airport, and it is a giant building and occupies a giant site. It was still in operation even 5 years ago. I went down to have a look at it when I first went to Berlin, and it really just took my breath away because it wasn't like a modern airport. It was obviously designed to be a bit like a railway station, you know, large waiting room, and you go in and everything is kind of very civilized. And then you go out and the planes are underneath this giant canopy. Now, the airport got dated, and Berlin has other airports. It's building a brand new modern one, Brandenburg International. And Tempelhof wasn't really seen to have much of a future. So Germany being Germany, they turned it into a public park, which seems like a very nice thing to do. So when people go to Berlin, go down there, have a look. It's really, really interesting. Probably, I'd say, top one quirky thing to do in Berlin.
Mm. So these are sort of historic airports that are now defunct or idle. And there's also Jerry's Castellón Airport near Valencia. As we heard, that's more of the new project that goes idle or just never really opens. And I read about another one of those in South Korea, and we'll link to a piece about that. One like Castellón, kind of big airport, way outside of Seoul, in a different part of Korea, expecting lots of traffic, and basically there's nothing happening.
There's an absurdity in there, isn't there, that building an airport and expecting people to fly to it. People don't fly to airports. People fly to places.
Exactly.
And so to do something like this, it does smack of a sort of vanity project, and people are kidding themselves slightly. You know, you have to have the population. You have to have people desiring to go there. But all of that said, we have seen huge amounts of traffic going through airports in the Arabian Peninsula in particular because there is a desire to make them into transit hubs. So you get people in while sending
really
them off somewhere
story.
Else. And then that's been one of the real dominant travel trends in world aviation over the past few years.
I know. I was so surprised to hear that the Middle East has become such a hub for flights, a transit point. I just had no idea. And no doubt, just the way the Middle East is developing, there'll simply be more and more visitors, whether it's for business or hopefully for tourism in a lot of places.
Well, and Qatar has the World Cup. It has ambitions to get more people in. It also has what many very large modern airports have, which is an absolute abundance of buses. There is a sort of direct correlation between the size of the airport and the sort of desire to make it into a very useful, impressive place, and the way that you're bussed 15 metres when you get off the plane. Get off the plane on a bus, 15 metres off again. You know, people can't be allowed to walk anywhere.
I just had a quick question for both of you, which is, in the research you do and the stories you do, do you see an overall demand for airports? I mean, are there projections for air traffic in certain parts of the world? We've talked about the Middle East, but are there other places where we're actually underserved by airports? Certain countries or regions need them, and so they should be built as opposed to these ghost ones.
Yeah, certainly China. Currently, China has invested $230 billion to build 45 new airports.
Wow. And what's interesting, 45, mostly 45. Passenger, commercial, both?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting about that is that they're sort of on the cusp of this new kind of hot idea, the aerotropolis, the idea of sort of building towns, little communities that are near, that are closer to airports that will sort of have their own kind of business and community hub. And Songdo in South Korea is sort of being looked at as like one of the early adopters of this kind of urban planning vision.
Where is Songdo in South Korea?
It's near Seoul.
Near. Okay, I see.
Yeah, and it's connected by a bridge to the Incheon International Airport. I may not be pronouncing
that correctly.
The I-N-C-H-O-N? Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I always say Incheon, but I have no idea if I'm pronouncing
Incheon
it right.
So it's connected by a bridge, and the idea, it's like a city that didn't exist. They just sort of built it because of its proximity to the airport, and it may be sort of a model for the future. And China is certainly looking at the fact that it has all these population clusters, some of which are not served by major airports, and thinking about, and especially as people have more discretionary income to travel. They want people to come in, obviously, for business and tourism, and they want people to be able to get out. So I'm sort of watching China to see what they do.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Tom, any thoughts on future airports or the need for them?
I think that basically the entire African continent could do with significant investment in aviation infrastructure. If you want to fly from one side of Africa to another, the cheapest way to do so is still to go via Europe. That would seem to me to be absolutely fundamental for development.
It's been an issue for our program, actually, over the past 15 years. And the issue is, okay, we need correspondence in Africa, but if we're going to place somebody from outside Africa in Africa, where do you place them? If to get to a different part of Africa, they need to go via London. So it's a very practical problem.
That's right. And I mean, I think the situation's got slightly better. You know, basing yourself in South Africa is a good idea. Kenya Airways has grown its network. Ethiopian Airways has grown its network, but certainly much more needed. And, in terms of thinking about economic development for the continent as a whole, I know you don't necessarily look at Africa as a whole, you look at it as a collection of countries, but that's something that is well worth considering.
I was speaking to some South Africans recently, and they love their new airport in Johannesburg. I haven't been there, but they say it's wonderful.
It does nice milkshakes.
Okay, finally, our last topic, the one we've all been waiting for, your pick for the airport you never, ever want to descend into ever again. And I'll just start with mine. And this was a while ago, so the airport could have changed, but this was in Honduras, the capital, Tegucigalpa. And to land into Tegucigalpa, which is a tiny airport, you're landing, you think everything's fine, and then at the last minute you have to thread the needle through two mountains, a really narrow pass through two mountains. It was terrifying. I was just like, oh my God. So I don't ever want to land there again. All right, David, do you have a favorite scary descent story?
No, I don't actually. I'm really actually sad about that. I think that even if I had, I would have thought of that as sort of fun and adventurous and wanted to go back. I'd be happy to go through two mountains or land on a short tarmac. The crazier and the weirder, the better. And I have to confess, I've never had I've had scary flights where I've flown through storms and that sort of thing. But in terms of an airport, I've never thought I was about to die or
That's great.
was worried something was going to – maybe I just need to go to crazier places.
Tom?
Well, I didn't nearly die there, but I've got no real desire to return to Asmara International Airport in Eritrea. And the main reason being that the flight sort of left at 3:30 in the morning, which is one of those ridiculous times to fly anywhere. So I thought, well, I'll just go to the airport and wait. But in the way that some airports do, particularly in developing countries, they don't let you into the terminal until much closer to the time that your flight is leaving. And what they kind of set up was a tent outside where you could go in and sort of sit around. But in the way of some gatherings in I must say, the lovely, you know, Eritrean people like to enjoy themselves, is by playing ear-screechingly loud music. Now, Asmara's at 2,000 metres. It was pretty cold at night. Had to wait in this tent. Had spent all my Eritrean money. So it was a very long few hours, and I was really pleased to fly out at the end.
Oh. Actually, I had one more thing I wanted to ask you guys. You write about travel, and obviously you travel all the time. So I just wanted to check in and where each of you have been recently. David, let's start with you.
My most recent trip was to Arizona, where I once lived. I used to live in Phoenix, and I was going out there for my brother's wedding, but he was on his way to go ski with his new wife, my sister-in-law now, and the first stop that they were going to make on their way to New Mexico to ski was Flagstaff, Arizona, one of the only two places you can ski in Arizona, and we all went along. My dad and
did your brother
my
enjoy
wife
that
and
having
sister.
You all there?
Yeah, I don't know. He was nice about it as we hung out in his suite at the hotel there. But we had a little family ski trip in Flagstaff, which is my favorite small town in America. It's just a great little town. It's
I've heard great things about Flagstaff. But yeah, I hear you have to cook things differently because you're at a high elevation.
Yeah. But the food's really great, and they have all these microbrews, and it's a college town, so it has this really interesting mix of characters walking around. And
that's great.
And you have to go there to get to the Grand Canyon. So next time you're there, don't just drive through it. Stop and hang out for a while.
Okay. Tom, you've been somewhere interesting lately. Tell us.
I'm about just over a month back from Syria in the Middle East.
Which is in the news, as everyone knows.
Obviously very much in the news. And my timing was good from the point of view of going there and being there while the situation was still calm. But it means that there's an added poignancy looking at the footage from the country. I've never been anywhere where people are so friendly, so open, so welcoming. All the sort of stereotypes of Middle Eastern hospitality are alive and well in Syria. I lost count the number of times I was invited to people's houses for dinner. Museums were opened especially for me, and people would cross the road
shake
my hand. It was absolutely fabulous. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. I just hope that what's going on there resolves itself as quickly and as peacefully as possible. And, you know, I hope that people won't be put off returning there. But I have to say, from a historical point of view, a cultural point of view, I don't think I've ever been anywhere quite so rewarding.
All right. That sounds fascinating. And I hope to make it to Syria someday, along with other Middle Eastern countries that, for the time being, seem to be off limits. Tom Hall is the London editor for Lonely Planet. He's been speaking to us from London. David Allen is the editor of the BBC's travel website. He's in New York. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carol.
Remember, you can find links, pictures, and all other kinds of stuff to enhance your podcast listening experience. Check out theworld.org/travel. Again, that's theworld.org/travel. That's also the place to find links to us on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, this is Carol Hills, talking travel.